Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, my name's Nick.
Hello, I'm Woogie.
We are the Mouth of Manliness. This is a podcast all about mental health. But it's not just mental health. It's kind of about people's lives and about how they cope and how they manage in the world.
Yeah, and digging into the stories that make them who they are.
Yeah, so it's real life stories where we talk about things that people have been through and how they've managed and how they've coped and how they've come out the other side. So sometimes it's just me and Woogie here, but more often than not, we're talking to guests, sometimes more well-known guests, but more often than anything, it's just normal people who have been through interesting situations.
Yeah, and they've all got a lovely story to tell.
Yeah, so Mouth of Manliness, we are about mental health, but we're more about people and stories.
So, welcome to the Mouth.
The Mouth of Manliness.
This is the Mouth.
All right, let's go. Welcome to the Mouth of Manliness. Season 3 in full effect. I'm Nick. I'm waving to no one.
He's waving to
and
no
this
one.
This is someone else.
I am Woogie, or Wogie, as you like calling me, or Warren, or, you know, Woogie. I've got a bundle of names, but Woogie. Woogie's my old nickname at school, and then therefore my name, so
yeah, I there don't you call go. You that much. and as ever, we've got a really great guest today, George Costa.
Yes, yes.
Welcome, George. Thanks for coming along.
No, thanks for having me on, mate. It's great.
It's lovely. It's, as I said just before, it was really lovely to see you. And like, I probably haven't seen you for at least 2, maybe 3 years. And,
yeah.
I'll never forget. So we first met at the White Room Studio, which is run by Mark Watts, and who's a character unto himself.
It's really
mad. Yeah. So, and we first met because you were helping out of the studio. And... And Mark was like, meet Wigwam. This is Wigwam. And that was it. And I'm like, I don't think he's called Wigwam, is he? And I really didn't want to call you it, especially as Mark had said it. But then, and I'd come out and you'd be sitting reading the book. And I was like, oh, there's a young man reading a book. What a lovely thing to see. And I instantly liked you. Yeah. You know, like, I instantly liked you. Then on the top of that, you were really, really cool. And like... Mm. I don't know, you just seem to consider things more than a lot of people, and I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I've known you, George, for a fucking long time, as it turns out, because Amy was... Mark used to manage Amy, right? So the mother of my children, my ex-partner. And I used to come down to... That's how I got introduced to you using the White Room Studios. So, I mean, I knew you when you were in... Was it Electric Child House she was in?
Yeah. Yeah.
But even before that, I think, weren't you? You was just in the studio. So like,
yeah, must be years and years now.
Yeah man, over 10 years, because Lola's 10, my daughter, so my eldest. So yeah, and it was a good few years before that. So I knew you like about 12 so years ago, Jules. And then ever since then, every sort of big production rehearsals I did with like Pip or B. Dolan, again... George is always responsible for waiting there to lock up for us to fucking finish with a good book, basically.
Quality. So when I heard you playing with Electric Child House, and I actually heard you playing,
yeah,
I was like, like, fucking hell, where did that come from? That's amazing. It sounded like you've been playing for years and years. Like,
yeah, I remember that. Yeah, just and picked it up, didn't you?
Just fucking
melody.
Properly floored, like real kind of dubby sound to it. Real decent bass.
I think I was lucky, obviously, being around the studio all the time. Mm. Also, like, well, I learned bass off of Bonzai from Space.
He's
a ridiculous bass player. So, yeah, it's just one of them things. I think as well, just where I sort of didn't play too long before joining a band, I think as soon as you join a band, like, it just pushes you a lot more than sitting at home learning on your own, you know. You sort of build up a bit of, I don't know, I think you just, when you're playing all the time, it just comes a bit more naturally, I guess.
I bought a guitar. I got a guitar for Christmas Day for my present and an amp. And then after Boxing Day, I had my first jam. And I'd never actually sat and learned anything. It just worked it out totally through playing with other people.
Yeah.
Completely.
Yeah.
It's a great way to do it. And
it forces you, because you learn from one another and all, didn't you? And it's like, there's always someone who's a flash fucker in the band. So it's quite good to be like, just see all the little tricks and just adapt to them. And it's the same with anything, production, whatever. Like, I've sat, like, you know, watching Mark fuck about on Logic. Like, I mean, interestingly with that, like, when I made the transition from being in I Shouted Gun, which was me just playing guitar, to making electronic stuff, I bought all of my Mac shit. I bought Logic, I bought a MacBook Pro, a sound card, and I phoned up Mark and went, Mark, how do I open up a plugin? Because I've opened it and I ain't got a fucking clue. But it's that mentality, isn't it? Like, you get around people that know what they're fucking doing, didn't you? And I love that. That's the best thing for me. Like, when you learn a new skill and because again, like, we've spoken about this on the podcast before, you then become part of like a gang.
Yeah.
And it's like you feel like you're a unit together.
And you don't want to let anyone down, do you? So you've got to fucking be good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
It was a really lovely time at the White Room, though. Like, I used to go every week, and there'd just be loads of really good bands, like lots of inspiration around, and everyone was really nice to each other.
Yeah,
a lot of that's down to like Mark. And you as well, George.
Yeah,
just made people feel welcome, and Mark would just walk in the middle of everything anyway. And
he's notorious for ruining a rehearsal like flow, isn't he? He'll pop in and he won't leave your rehearsal for half hour. And you're like, Mark, like, I mean, I'm paying you. You've just done me half hour, you cheeky fucker.
The amount of bands, man, who come down here and go, you know what, we had a right laugh, but we've done fuck all.
Fuck all, I know.
4 hours.
Yeah.
Like, oh, mate.
So is Mark, are you Mark's nephew?
Yeah. I mean, so he's my mum's brother. Yeah.
That's quite nice, isn't it? So, you're doing counselling. You're doing your counselling qualification at the moment.
Yeah, I'm doing I'm in my second year of it's a level 5 diploma in counselling, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so coming along pretty well. I had a bit of a break, well, not a break, sort of a false break after the first year. I had an operation, which put me out of action for a bit. But right. I'm now back into it again, which is nice.
What was it? What was it? Something private?
The operation?
Yeah.
I was born with like an indented chest.
Oh, my brother-in-law's got that.
Right.
Yeah.
You can rest the glass in it.
I had to have like a metal bar wired behind my ribcage.
Fucking hell. So that must have been fun for you.
That put me out of action for about...
Fucking hell.
That's 6 months, probably.
Really?
Yeah. Which I mean, it's good. He got it sorted. So it's just nice now to be... Well, as soon as I got better, I was sort of looking forward to doing stuff again. Mm. And then... Mm. All this happened, so that was that was great.
Yeah.
I haven't done anything for about 2 years. But,
so was it causing you lots of grief before?
I just started having like chest pains and stuff. And since I was a kid, I've been to the doctors and just said, "Is this all right?" and all the rest of it. And they just sort of said, "Yeah, you know, no problem." Yeah. And then one doctor, I went for a checkup. I had a cough or something. She said, "I take your shirt off, do like a stethoscope on your back and that." Yeah, she was like, "Oh my god, your chest! What's going on there?"
Really?
Like, you don't hear that from a doctor, do you? I was like, "I don't
know."
No.
She was like, "I'm going to bring this up in my meeting on Sunday." I was like, "God, this is a bit."
Yeah.
So then she sent me for an MRI and all that, and they were like, "Yeah, Your sternum's like crushing your heart, so you're going to have this done. I was like, that's Andy.
Yeah.
It all happened in the space for about 2 weeks.
Oh my God.
It was a bit mad. But
I suppose you, like, if something like that happens, you want them to just get on it.
In all fairness, they just smashed it through to like the consultant and like the surgeon and stuff. Yeah, I had up at St. Bart's up in
London.
Right, like, brilliant. Yeah, really good.
Oh, mate.
You know what? A lot of people I talk to have had like serious kind of surgery in the London hospitals. They're always like they're amazing. They always say really good things.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think sometimes in the Essex ones, they're shit.
Yeah, I've been buzzed on a couple of times. That's a bit of a funny one.
Yeah, it is.
It's an interesting hospital, that. Oh, dear.
So what got you into counselling then, Georgie? I always think it's really fascinating because it's something that normally takes someone into that world of work. Like, I work in mental health now. And it's like, of course I do.
Of course you do.
See,
because what's interesting, just to cut in before you answer, is that being in the studio all the time, seeing you play in Electric Child House and that as well, and I went to one gig or two gigs, I think, with Mark, I saw you. But like,
yeah, I've seen.
I mean, like, I always assumed then you'd just be in a band, to be honest with you, and that'd be it. Because, you know, Mark, don't fuck about, everyone's good musicians and stuff, and I assumed that was it. But so, like, if you want to sort of go from where you went from there to now where you are, that'd be lovely to hear.
That's interesting, yeah. Do you mind?
So it all started really when I was a kid. From age of about 11, maybe 10, I just always had like terrible anxiety. Always had like just about sort of like nonsensical, just like sort of ridiculous reasons. Like my rationale, my reasoning was always sort of very uncalibrated. I remember once I just had this sudden like random fear that like the moon was going to crash into the earth.
Right.
But in my head, it would just escalate to the point where I just wouldn't function. I mean, and it was just sort of like one thing after the other. It just went on for ages. I just didn't really. I think I got like put onto like a paediatrician who did. He put me on serotonin.
Sertraline.
I can't think what it was called now. I can't remember the.
Some tablets increase your serotonin.
I can't think what it was called now. I can't remember the original one. I'm there on like SSRIs.
Yeah,
selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, I think they are.
Yeah.
But is it sertraline or something like that? Anyway.
It's sertraline. I've had sertraline before, and like, they do use it for anxiety and depression.
That was the stuff, yeah. So they put me on that. It just didn't really get better, and it just sort of carried on for years to the point where eventually, I don't know, I just really just stopped functioning. I was really worried about going there. I had this weird thing about, I don't know, like, it'd be something mad, like, I'd be in my car and I'd park up wrong somewhere, like in the incorrect place to park.
Yeah.
And I basically admitted like I've broken a crime or something, and I thought the police were going to arrest me, and I ended up developing acute paranoid psychosis for about 3 years, and it just ruined the life.
That's fucking serious.
like you saying about coming to see ECH play.
Yeah.
I was just terrified like the entire time I was playing. Because I thought I had like this mad thing about getting arrested. It was like, oh God, they'll know I'm going to be here at this date playing at this certain time.
Yeah,
and I would never enjoy myself. I just wanted to get up, which is terrible, really, because, you know, they were great nights. And I think by the time I resolved it, the band was sort of like winding down. So I didn't really enjoy much of it as much as I would have liked to.
Fucking hell. So that was... that was from... quite a young age then. You're like me, you like had problems early.
Just to clarify, George, how old are you now?
Yeah, I'm 26.
So you're 26, right?
I can't believe it.
So I met you when you were, so back to that, yeah. So you was about 14 or something when I met you, yeah.
I remember being at the Civic Hall. Yeah. Like I was playing with Serious Problem, and George came, and I was just getting. George was underage, and I was just getting drinks. And we were just hanging out and talking about like
about Mark loved
and things like that. And I'm like, this is a proper conversation. Yeah, it was. I remember that, and I went so well. So that's fucking. That's the thing. I don't think people often people just kind of put anxiety. People don't realise how debilitating anxiety can be, and then the thing is, when we talk about psychosis, psychosis is proper ramps it up. You know, like psychosis is relatively speaking rare. You know, it's like it's not. You know, it's not
so
every day.
I relate to that sort of that sense of like feeling that the old bill are going to nick you sort of thing or something or whatever as a result of like I've put myself in that because of drug use.
Yeah.
Like 100%. Like I've sat in like my back room of my old house thinking like the every terrible thought, like the level of paranoia is literally crippling. It will cause psychosis. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. So it's I've literally sat there in absolute fear for 4 hours until the drug wore off, and then be like, right, I'm never fucking doing that again. And that's like a very different sort of reaction, I guess. Yeah. But fucking hell, yeah.
That reminds me of doing LSD. That's pretty much the outcome of whenever I do LSD. I'm not made for doing those kind of drugs. So what? So over those 3 years, George, when it was, you know, like acute, what were you doing at that point, just to give people an idea of what it's kind of what it might look like?
Well, I was the main thing I was only really doing at the time was the band. But in terms of like my behaviour, I didn't like doing anything like electronically, like communicating, because it was like, I don't know, people don't know where I am or something. Didn't like go anywhere, like whenever I saw like a CCTV camera. Proper weirded me out.
Yeah.
Just loads of stuff. I mean, it just completely like derailed any sort of normal life. As I say, like when it came to the band, you know, everything was just a lot harder. And I think looking back now, like maybe I wouldn't have replied to text and even like urgently replying to about something. And I really wanted to, but it was just out of this sort of irrational fear I developed. You know, or doing gigs or anything like that, really. You know, having photos taken, anything. It just really, I mean, I never actually felt like that before. Like when you said about drug use, it's like it just felt like I was pranging out 24/7.
Yeah,
it's like because
that thing with like using things like coke and things like that, which is what I've used in the past, and it's like that feeling. Like when you take that shit in a non-jubilant way, like not just like having a line in the pub, blah blah blah. I mean, like in the studio, doing it at home on your own, and then sitting there, fuck it. And that I remember that what it is, psychosis, really, to a point. I got myself into that, and I remember that being, it's so irrational, like because you. I'd put my phone like off and shit, and I recognise that behaviour like only because of that, from a different a different origin. But it's amazing how your body and your brain go into that same default mechanism at times. I think where it, like it's better to just be completely shut off, just in case something happens. And I've felt like that, like between the hours like 1 a.m. and 8 a.m. Yeah. And then you sort of come round a bit, and it's like, fucking hell! Like I'm, and it's like you've gone through something.
I know, but quite 24 hours a day for 3 years.
Mate. Oh, I know. Yeah, this is what I mean. Yeah.
So what pulled you through then, Georgie? What was the what got you out the other side?
I think one of the main things in the end was that I ended up going to a psychiatrist first of all. It was great, a guy called Dr. Wimbo, who just really helped me out. He put me on SSRIs, which at first, I don't know if you had the same experience, or I know quite a lot of people do, is that during like maybe the first week of taking it, you actually get worse for some reason.
Right.
it becomes, it almost ramps up weirdly. It will then start getting slowly sort of better. I would say it's definitely like, in terms of medication, I mean, obviously it's always best to sort of steer clear, I think, from medication if you can, for stuff like this. But there is like, it's a good sort of shock treatment, in my opinion. Yeah, like when you're in that bad a place, it's good at quickly pulling you out. I think the only problem is sometimes it can be like a lot, it can be quite like trial and error to find the right medication that works for you.
Yeah, you're completely right.
It makes you 10 times worse, really odd.
That's been my experience, is that I think that's part of the problem. I don't think docs explain it very well. Is that it is a bit of an experiment. It's about finding the right mix of what works for you. And that can take quite some time. And along the way, you might be coming off of one drug onto... This is what happened to me. I came off of one drug and then went on to another drug, and I was out for 6 weeks. I was out. You know, I was I was having proper massive withdrawals, and then going on to the other drug, because I was kind of weak from coming off of the last one, it kicked my ass. Absolutely. Yeah. And like they are strong things. And I think what you say is, like, medication is a really useful tool because it gets you to the point where you can start to work it out. And you can't work it out when you're in a state, you know, like you can't see sense, can't you? So the drugs kind of numb you a little bit. They get you... That's why I often think, you know, that doctors are quite quick to prescribe antidepressants. Primarily, they actually prescribe quite low-level ones. But it needs to be backed up with the talking therapy, you know.
Medication won't solve your issue, you know, in terms of, like, truly getting to what the issue is. It will help. I think, for me, medication allowed me to... function on a normal level again, to then be able to go to talking therapy. That was the main thing for me.
Was that your first experience of talking therapies?
So mine was, I mean, I guess with a psychiatry, there's a certain amount of that involved. But after that, I just found a therapist called, she's brilliant, called Gabriella Clark, her name is.
Right.
And she just helped me out so much. I think for me, one of the main things in therapy initially, it's just that very sort of cathartic thing. You've been able to get a lot of stuff off your chest. These faults and, you know, sort of feelings that sort of kick around in your nut for ages. They just drive you mad. You know, you just create these vicious cycles for yourself. And it is mad. It's something I've definitely learned through the counselling training, is you end up sort of questioning yourself a bit more. But just when you say something out loud and somebody sort of almost goes, why do you think that? That's not, you know, sort of in a roundabout way, almost saying that is pretty mad. And you're like, yeah, it is.
Or they say, yeah. I'm not surprised, you know, yeah, you think that way because.
Yeah.
Like, it's.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't.
That's a revelation situation then, when that happens for me.
I didn't have, I saw a psychiatrist when I was younger, and I had bits of therapy when I was younger. But I didn't. It didn't all click until a few years ago, when a psychiatrist was like, "Oh, you have this, and you have that, and you have this, and you have that. That's because you're borderline personality disorder." And it's like, you know, suddenly all these fucking things that go on in my head, they've got an answer, and they're like, "Yeah, and we can sort that out." And you're like, "Oh, great." But yeah, it helps to have someone to tell you that, you know you're going a bit mad, but it helps someone to say, yeah, that happens.
Or say, obviously, not you say a bit mad, not in that sense, or more so being able to, you know, get another perspective on it and have you look at it and say, you know, it's just looking at it from another angle. It's just where you definitely get stuck in like these sort of like neural sort of racetracks almost, just go round and round. And it's really hard for you to escape that sort of like riverbed almost you've made, you know, it just flows in one direction. It just allows you to go off on another sort of path and you think, oh, right, yeah, if you look at it that way.
It's funny what you said about, like, when I started working at probation, like, I did my training and I also did, like, CBT courses. And as I was doing it, I'm like, I do that. You know, like, this is all, this is about thinking. It's not about, like, you know, criminals. This is about, like, and then realise it. And then, like you said, you know, you start questioning yourself a little bit more. You start questioning your thoughts and thinking, oh, no, that's not right, is it? Like, maybe I don't need to do that. But it's really hard when you've done it. It's like you, when you've done it, like, most of your life. That's the hardest part, isn't it? It's hardest to change it then. So, so did you have, like, because I found psychiatrists would come in, they'd go, right, different medication, this is your diagnosis, and I prescribe you psychotherapy. That's what happened to me. Like, the psychiatrists don't spend a lot of time with you, really.
No, I mean, I think more so, I mean, it's a doctorate, isn't it, psychiatry, in terms of, I think the main thing is to be able to, for them, is to be able to sort of narrow down what, you know, put a label on, in a good way, I guess, on what your disorder is, and then medicate you sort of accordingly. And obviously, I think a lot of people, you think psychiatrists, you think like maybe more really what a therapist does in a sense.
Yeah,
you think you're laying like a...
Yeah, you're thinking Freud.
Like a leather chaise lounge and like, you know, talking to him. But that they are doctors, basically. In that sense, very much so. But yeah, definitely, like a therapist would be more that idea of, you know, someone you go and actually talk through problems with, I guess.
Yeah, and that's why I think, you know, sometimes people say, like they feel like seeing a counsellor isn't weighty enough, and it's like, no, it is. It can be exactly what you need it to be. It doesn't actually matter massively who it is, as long as you kind of click and you can you feel comfortable with. That's all you need.
No, definitely. Like, I think it is just finding the person that's right for you. Like, I think I went to a couple of counsellors before I found the one I use now. And it's I probably had it a bit like, oh, it's not really working for me. But like the first couple of times, and it probably, to be honest with you, after that third time, if it didn't work again, I probably would have given up. But it is just persevere and find someone that you get on well with.
I
found it was like I had like NHS counselling that was for me for anxiety and for essentially like borderline depression, and then I had a bit of CBT and like, but I remember it being like the NHS sort of situation being very matter of fact. And I never felt quite. I was just in an office, and it was like, you got 3:45 minutes, so like, hurry the fuck up is what it was. And then someone introduced me to somebody else, and then I remember thinking that with that person that I was being. I felt I was being overanalyzed, and I didn't like them. Basically, it felt to me. It was a middle-aged lady. I was sort of in my young 20s, and she was kind of a bit matter-of-fact and telling me how my life was. And I was like, "You're not really listening to what I'm saying."
Was she right though? Looking back,
no, she wasn't actually. No, she was just a bit of an arsehole.
Is what I thought. Shouldn't really be doing that.
And anyway, then I met somebody else. His name was Gareth, and he. He was really good. I'd split up with like my ex by that point, and yeah, he was. He was really, really. It become very easy to just talk how I do to my friends. Like I've said on this podcast before, like I probably have a relationship with my close friends that is more like a counselling relationship now. As a result of being able to talk so openly and it being well received.
That's a good luck story. Not a good luck story, but that is a really good story.
It worked.
Then what happened then, George? So did you make sense of it? Most things are attachment.
I just found it really helped me going along, really, and just being able to talk. And I think the CBT that she worked with me on helped a lot, just to sort of break. Because my main thing, even though there's sort of, I guess, there's probably deeper issues here and there, but not really. It was just like my thought cycle and that thing of getting stuck in sort of negative thought patterns. And it was just being able to break out of that, really, and just learn to sort of when, learn when to tell myself to go, you know, this is irrational, or it's like, this isn't real, this isn't realistic, you know, this is just you doing what you do.
Yeah.
So I've definitely been able to sort of take a step back from that.
Yeah, that's the most powerful thing, stepping back from your thoughts. It's like, we can do it, we just don't really know we can do it. And and it's easy to, and it is relatively easy to do over time. But if you're not, do you have dips now? Do you have periods when it's kind of kicking you up the arse a bit?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's normal, though. I think, you know, everyone has bad days, or days when everything gets on top of you. Or, you know, it might not be for any reason. You might just wake up and that day you're just anxious or whatever it may be. But no, definitely, I know what you mean. I do have dips.
But it's, I find, like, when I'm having a dip, I kind of forget everything that I've been taught. Then when I kind of come out of the dip, I'm like, oh, fuck, I forgot. I haven't been doing this. I haven't been doing that. I haven't been, I haven't been doing gratitude. Or, oh, fuck, I forgot about acceptance. I'm a massive advocate for therapy of any sort. And it always comes down to, like, these basic truths. Have you found that through your studies? Like the concepts, they're all quite straightforward, but they all fucking work.
Our course teaches it's called a pluralistic approach. So it's taking like the three main approaches. So it's like CBT, person centered, and psychodynamic. Right. It's mixing all those three things. I think it can be a bit overwhelming sometimes, because it's like, we'll do one approach, then next module is the next thing, and it's trying to like keep, it's a lot of information, a lot of like history as well, you know, in terms of how all these things were developed, into one.
Do you have to study the history, Jules?
No, only to the extent where you sort of understand the origins of it and whatnot, and where it came from and why it was developed and whatnot. So with CBT, you might look at like saying like Pavlov with like conditioning, and then Carl Rogers, who like developed person centered, all that sort of stuff. CBT with Pavlov with the conditioning stuff, and then moving on to Aaron Beck, who was like the founder of CBT. I think a lot of the concepts are straightforward. Yeah. It's almost just when you get into like the really sort of nitty gritty bits of it. But I think that's probably when you study a particular approach a lot more closely, and sort of down to the, you know, minutiae of what it's about. Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely, like, you know, you can sort of sum all them approaches up in like a sentence in terms of how they take on problems and issues.
Mm. That's my favourite thing about it. Like my wife did psychology at Reading University, and she quite often, she don't roll it out very often at all, but like once in a while she'll say something and I'm like, oh, that's so and so, because I had to, for my degree I had to study a bit of all of that as well, and then since then I've studied quite a few things and I'm a big fan of like Jung and Freud, because it's fucking fascinating. And it all kind of plays into the same thing, and I love the fact that it is actually, you know, all you really need, if you can grab hold of that sentence, that sentence will fucking serve you really well. Mm. You know, like, I'm such a believer in that, these one lines. So how come, was it your experience of struggling with your mental health that kind of guided you in that direction?
Yeah, definitely. After I had cancer, I was like, this is great, you know, this has helped me out immeasurably. And I know there's a lot of people I know that would sort of benefit from it as well. And I think I definitely, after that, thought as well, to an extent, like, it would be better to sort of go into it than someone who knows what it's like to feel that shit, you know, and feel that awful. So that definitely bored me. And I think as well, looking at the counselling profession in general, there aren't many men and there aren't many young men.
That's true.
Yeah.
like not in a pretentious way, like Abby, and I don't know, it might just be a bit more approachable if, like, I don't know, a middle-aged fellow sees, I don't know, a fellow with a bald head and tattoos or something.
Yeah.
In a weird way, rather than going to, like, it's weird. I've always gotten better. Whereas a lot of women in my family, I've always felt more comfortable talking to women.
Yeah, women. Me too.
There are a lot of blokes who would, you know, really wouldn't want to speak to a woman. They'd rather speak to a man or vice, you know, various things. But I definitely feel like on that front, I'd like to work on that area and try and bring a new sort of.
Yeah, it's so true. It's the caring professions are primarily women. So, like, most of the jobs I've had have been, like, you know, a good 80% women, which I quite like, because then there's no, like, macho shit really floating around. That makes me happy.
Yeah, I understand.
It stops me feeling like I'm gay. that's my default thing, you know, like, oh, these men think I'm gay because I don't like football. But but what I've really noticed, like, I've started working in mental health, and the main thing that kind of got me my job was that, like, the first thing I said in the interview, and I put it all in the application as well, was that I have issues with my mental health, and that is why I want to do it. And they said, you've had lived experience. That's amazing. Like, yes, we want you. Like, we'll look after you. Yeah, we'll take you and we'll look after you. And we accept you because...
But again, it comes back to, like, allies and gang mentality, doesn't it? If you're sat in front of somebody that's been affected, it's that thing of, like, open honesty. Like, and again, actually, it does, like, come down, like, the toxic masculinity and people that, like, have that, like, stiff upper lip bullshit. They're the ones that are fucking dying inside, and they need an outlet as well. So to be able to sort of promote that in another way could be an interesting thing, because
it normally comes out in anger, though, doesn't it?
It does, like, yeah. 3 pints of Stella and a fight on a weekend, yeah, of course, which I get.
Yeah.
But there is beauty in conversation, and there's beauty in experience as well. I find, like, when you get that little click with someone, and they go, or they'll say something, and it resonates so hard with you that you get flutters, and you're like, "Oh, fucking hell! Actually, yeah, like, I really, really, really understand that." And you go home, and it's like a chapter, and in your life just starts again. That's what happened to me. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like you can foresee what. That you know they've been through it. Do you know what I mean? And all those dark fucking days is where it all comes
every
from.
Thursday night.
Yeah,
I get it. Yeah, every you Thursday do. Night. I'm talking to you, George. You've just told me your mental health journey, and I can talk to you about mine. And like Warren can talk about his.
Yeah,
and it's like so lucky to get every week.
It's really interesting for me, like, because I mean I you'll often find to our listeners as well on this podcast that I will zone out a little bit and just listen to. So I listened to you both really talk about certain elements, because I've had my own journey, but I've got elements of both of them. So to hear you talk about it, I am just sat there like, you know, much like our listeners, I hope as well. And it's exactly that, like, to counsel. Do you know what I mean? It's that thing is so detrimental to us to sort of get better and be better, I think. And like, because. I don't know, I relate it to sort of when you shut down because of things, and you stop doing what you're good at, or you stop all of your positive traits, all the best things about you. For me, like, I just literally just fucking put them in a box and they're gone for however long it takes me to get over that situation. And like, during those dark days, I'll self-destruct, I mean chemically near enough kill myself probably with alcohol and other things. And it's that cycle is only ever broken by another human being.
Funnily enough, like, I totally get what you're saying, because I do the same. I still self-destruct. You know, yeah, like
I still do it.
Like we were saying earlier, you still have blips. You still have bad days, like George said. And I certainly still have those days when days or weeks when I might self-destruct. And I do exactly what you said. And it's frustrating because it's like, will I ever be better? Will I ever be better?
Yeah, I know, yeah. But
and it's like, well...
But it's interaction, like,
will you ever get to nirvana? You know, like... No, you know, event, and you probably won't until you die. You know, like, it's all the fucking journey. And it's difficult.
But it is all the journey. I mean, it's like, it's quite inspiring listening to you, George, like, saying, because you've been directly reactive in my head, like, so exactly what you've been through, to then have, like, the strength to go, no, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to and look at it from a really sort of positive side, actually, but by learning more about it, by making it your essential career path as well, which is what it will be, alongside music and things, I'd hope as well, you know, because you'll be able to flourish using the information that you have from people, I think. But it is quite inspiring in that sense.
Oh, it is. Yeah, I was, you put out a thing saying, does anyone want for you to kind of learn with?
Mm. Oh,
I'm
yeah.
like, yep, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And but the thing is, I was just thought, oh, yeah, that's perfect.
Mm.
Like, I could see you doing that, because you've got, like, this kind of quite a calming thing about you. And it,
yeah,
then,
you have
it, to. Then it took me back to when I'd first met you, and I'm like, yeah, you're... you don't feel the need to speak all the fucking time like I do. you were always in a kind of observer.
I think that was just hanging around with Mark too much.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, I have a sort of every 3 week call with Mark, and that call stops and starts about 4 times because of other calls that he has. And then we'll have, and it'll be the length of roughly 2.5 hours solid, and that's just on a phone. And then when you're there, everyone in the building knows Mark's there. You know now everyone in the building, but this is why he's an important character.
But this is what's really interesting about Mark.
It's inspiring in itself, to be honest with you.
What is really interesting about Mark, and we're talking about him like he's a myth of a person, and he kind of is.
Oh, he is. He's a fucking beautiful man.
Terrible. He's terrible. He's wound me up so many times. and I'm fucking calm. He'll be like in your face and wind you up, and then when my son was born, literally like a couple of days later, I got a call from him out of the blue, and he was like, "So you had a kid? Oh, that's brilliant, man! That's brilliant! Oh, that's fucking brilliant!" And he was really, really lovely, so he's really nurturing. Like, did he know about that you were unwell, George?
Yeah, massively. I mean, Mark said his own stuff in the past as well, so I think he sort of recognised to an extent, you know, that I was in bother, maybe if other people couldn't quite pick up on it. Mark's been a massive help, man. I mean, all my life, like, he's like a father figure, you know what I mean, massively. I mean, even... when I was a kid, I have mild Asperger's, so I always really struggled sort of communicating with people, massively. Always seemed to get with older people as well, generally. Mm. So down at the studio for me was great because it was just lovely people who were into music. I don't really think I've met many musicians who are knobs, to be honest with you. Generally speaking,
I think that is one of the beauties of knowing Mark. And again, knowing the studio and the people that are there,
it brings people together.
It does bring, like, as I sort of said before, when I've walked in there, if I've just gone for a meeting with him or just to chat about something or just bowled into the old white rooms or the new ones or whatever, it'll take me in every door and say, "This is Warren. Scratchy in the corner. This is arsehole. This is that." And that's who he is, isn't he? But that natural inclusive nature, what it means is that it's more about community. As opposed to sort of pushing people away. And we've spoken on this podcast before.
Completely.
Like when you play in Essex and things, every fucker's jealous of one another, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
but
not like
there.
And Mark
more or less made that his way because he's not like that. He's a very loving fucking human.
Yeah.
I've never had the hump with Mark. I have. I'm sure you have. But what's funny about it is that
we've
been in rehearsals and he's taken a piss out of every single band member in varying levels of production as well. Like I'm talking like some quite high end, like the Yanks that were over like touring with us. Really? And like I can't say that, can
just
I?
Just takes a piss.
Yeah, I don't know. Like all like the boys from Strange Famous and that, and like he. But immediately then, after a few like trips to Tesco with him in the car, to then come back to the studio and that, he's like, he's got a very natural, inclusive nature. And
it's quite infectious, isn't it?
It is very infectious. So I think it would naturally bring a younger person in that environment out of their shell.
It's quite nice, you know what I mean? You've got to, like,
I can see it in him as well.
I never really had that thing at school where I had... like a group of mates where you sort of learn, I don't know, just like the band and stuff.
Yeah.
I never quite got that. But when I was down there, I met, I met Matt Ollie, Jack Harry, Dan Bracknell, Luke, like so many of them. And it was like having 20 brothers, do you know what I mean? It was just great. Like, I really would have struggled without that place. And I think a lot of other people would as well. It just meant a lot to so many people. It still does, you know.
It is special because like I'm still in touch with like Matt and Ollie, and even Bonsai and that. Like I'll make comments and that, I know if I saw him, it would be like, give us a hug and Brick as well. All amazing musicians. It's a special place. Music has got a special thing. So when you I'll go back to shop.
Of course.
So my son's got Asperger's. They don't diagnose Asperger's anymore, but I hear it thrown around mental health all the time. But
I think it's just altered in there. I don't think they necessarily diagnose it anymore.
When you got older and like you so. For example, you went through that bad period and then you kind of come out. Did they talk about autism? Did they think that had much to do with it?
Possibly. I mean, it's kind of that thing where, weirdly enough, we had a thing the other day on my course about this thing called stress diaphysis model, which I think the idea that where they're sort of like you have genetic and sort of environmental predispositions.
Yeah.
To mental illness, basically. So it could be a genetic thing where it runs in your family, but like, autism is one on there just because where you see the world differently. You know, things that may be completely normal, I guess, to other people may just stress you out, like, you know, like lack of routine or just sort of throwing something in the mix out of nowhere. Loads of stuff like that. I mean, I really struggle with, for example. I mean, I've not got. You know, very severe sort of autism, but I'd even struggle with, like, if somebody tells me what to do in terms of like instructions, I really need direct, literal instructions. Otherwise, I really struggle. For example, I don't know. Yeah, I just find it
very, very clear.
Yeah,
like, my son's autism's kind of like, I think, you know, it's relatively like it's not. That it causes massive issues, but it's, you know, it's fucking obvious, and he's very much like, if you give him a rule, like he needs to know the parameters. You can't just be vague. You need to say, right, this is what you do now, and then he's fine. But and also, like, if you routine changes, it's quite difficult. So like, if we go on holiday, we try and stick to the same routine as much as possible, and then he doesn't get distressed. But luckily enough, he's not too bad. But I could see how if you're having issues of anxiety, like I see him getting stressed out about, like, you know, he's really into Legends of Zelda, and he's like, and he'll work out, he's got it all going on in his head about like almost like a role play in his head, and then he'll hit something and he's like, I don't know what to do now, and like he starts getting quite distressed about that, and like he's just
which is interesting because like I was a gamer when I was a kid, I fell out of it the minute I started playing music at 13 or something. But that those games are they're designed for problem solving, aren't they?
Yeah, but so, it's very.
So with that, like you can find like a puzzle solution in it.
Yeah,
you can. But the actual point of it from the standard role playing game perspective is that you're constantly faced with issues to unravel.
Yeah.
So if you can't find sense in that, in the situation, not just you're not meant to find sense in it, obviously, but the situation, I mean, of it just constantly throwing it at you.
I think the thing is why a lot of people with autism particularly like gaming,
yeah,
and like. D&D and that kind of thing, because it's very process driven.
Yes, right, of course. Yeah.
And like, if there's a process, you can make sense of
it. And once you learn that process, it becomes second nature to you, and it doesn't distress you.
It's comforting because it's like, right, you do that and then you do that, and I do the same.
Yeah,
you know, like
I think I do.
I don't do anything. Like I'm really fucking predictable. Like, I really am. Predictable as shit. I do that then, I do that then, and I do that then. And I notice in myself that the genetics for Jude have come from me. Because I'm very mild, but I need all that shit as well.
I've got to cut in here quickly because I meant to show you, but I did delete it sadly. But there was two text messages from a week before on a Sunday at 7:07 saying, let's do this.
Oh, no,
and then
really?
Another one at 7:07, I think.
Really?
Look at your phone. I'm pretty sure it was.
But you know
what?
That's
not a conscious thing, but as far as things go, that's fucking funny.
But you know what I'll do? I'll sit there all Sunday going, right, I need to text Warren, but I don't want to make him feel pressured.
Yeah, cool.
And so I'm doing all of those things, you know, like when your brain's being an arsehole and you're like, I don't want to make him feel pressured. I don't do that. And then I'm like, right, 7 o'clock is okay. Right, actually, I'll have a fag.
Yeah,
and I'll do it while I'm having a fag.
Yeah,
and then at 7:07, and like, fuck it, like,
or whatever it was.
I learned
whatever.
Shit about myself, it's, and it embarrasses me. So where are you at now, then, Georgie? How long have you been doing it?
So I've done about 50% of the course overall now. So a year and a half and 3 years. That's going well. So the first year was hypnotherapy, which sort of acted as like a pretty good sort of like a springboard into counseling, I guess. You've got a few things.
Massive fan. I'm a massive fan of hypnotherapy. I fucking love it.
No, it's really the one thing I think I've found. It's weird as well. It seems to be one of them things where, like, I've had different tutors who really view it differently. Some are very pro hypnotherapy and think it can work for a lot of things, and others just kind of write it off and. I think it's definitely a susceptibility thing. Some people it just works really well for.
Yeah.
And like you might go for like, I don't know, smoking cessation and it'll cure you and it'll be great. Other people just won't work at all. I think it's good for mindfulness.
Definitely. Yeah, it's great for that.
It's like a relaxing thing to clear your mind. It definitely helps a lot.
I think when you go into these things, you have to want it to work.
Yeah.
If you want, you can't go into. The thing is with hypnotherapy is that it's got such a bad reputation that when you go into it, a lot of people are like, go on, then fucking surprise me. And it's actually not that fucking intense. It's not like taking ecstasy. It's not like that. It's actually quite gentle. And if you go in there going, fucking impress me, you won't be impressed. Because it won't work. You have to go into it going, I want it to work. I fucking need something to work. I love it.
I mean, one of the first things in that first year that I sort of teach you is how to explain to people what hypnotherapy actually is.
Yeah, I bet.
Because I think it is just associated a lot with like more like what we call mentalism, which is like go to buttons and there's some bloke saying like, right, you're going to pull your hands together and you can't pull them apart and no one can. You know, it's all this kind of like, it's just like suggestibility.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, you know, got a lot of uses. Especially
did you have to have it to do the training?
We practiced on each other in like sort of like class practice sessions and stuff. I enjoyed it. I think it's definitely a good tool within, you know, sort of therapy. And then I think this year we moved on to sort of basic, well, sort of like sort of basic counselling skills, basically.
So looking at three main approaches, mm-hmm. Which we've done, which was, yeah, psychodynamic, person-centered, then we're doing CBT at the moment. Should be really interesting. So it's nice just delving a bit deeper into it all, really. And you definitely start picking out things, and looking at the approaches that you really like dealing with.
Yeah.
I don't know, what appeals to you straight away. So for me, like, psychodynamic was really interesting for me because it's looking into the past and it's really getting to the heart of matters.
It's the more what people would think psychiatry is.
Yeah.
It's like, you feel that, like, hold on, I've done it with my job for years, you know, it's like, oh, someone's committed a crime. And then I'm like, tell me about your mother, you know.
Yeah, right.
Tell me about, like, your parents. And then I can pretty much then start to put a line across.
Yeah.
But you can't over-hypothesise. It's important not to do that. But psychodynamics really interesting. And I think there's so much truth in it.
Mm. Well, like you say, it's almost what you'd associate more with, like, a psychiatrist.
Mm.
I think that is the idea you get from is Freud, who came from the psychoanalysis and free association and sort of techniques. Mm. But yeah, I found that really interesting. Person-centered, I liked some of it, but I find it quite a bit of a strange one because you're not sort of probing too much, just letting, like, the client discover their issue almost. So you could be there, you could be there 2 weeks or like 2 years almost. I don't know.
I have to say, I like the fact that they do it together though, because what can happen is you get someone to a point with that kind of psychodynamic when they're on the edge of making like that breakthrough, and then switch it up with person centered. And then they make the breakthrough for themselves. And
yeah, true.
Hallelujah, there's a better person.
Mm. You know, definitely. I think it's where we've been looking at things separately at the moment. The idea of the pluralistic thing, for what I can tell, is obviously to integrate them all together and use that you say there, like using the tools at your disposal accordingly.
Yeah, I had therapy of mind for 2 years, and the therapist I had there was... Chris, he was amazing, and like we just got on.
Mm.
And like I did go in there with like, I don't have no CBT, man. Because I was like, I used to teach CBT. I get it. I'm not stupid. I get it. And he's like, well, I'm not telling you. We'll just mix it up if you like. And I was like, oh, cool.
And
we did use CBT. We use CBT every time. But just
putting a label on your progress isn't necessary, is it? Because it's a journey, isn't it? Like so every sort of little building block that's used in order for you to become well I think it's definitely down to the person. Like you said, he's amazing, and I think that's exactly it. It's like the approach of somebody with other people, like and not carrying maybe a preconceived thought, because everybody does, right? In life, they just do it with other people, inclusive of counsellors and therapists.
I think what people do, they figure out why you're that way, and then they prove why you are. Bias, when you're like, right, that's what it is.
That's what it is,
And then all you do is prove that, and that's all you work on. And like with that kind of pluralistic and... multimodal approach, you don't do that. Like,
well, that would enhance a lack of empathy.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't necessarily be reactive to someone's actual emotive reaction.
Mm.
And
God, listen to our words.
Yeah,
listen to our words.
And lack of empathy means you're a fucking psychopath.
Yeah.
So, which we all are a little bit.
What good have words?
You, yeah. Have you read Psychopath Test by what's it?
John Ronson. They still use that.
Such a good book.
The thing is, when you read that and then they talk about the BDSM, it's not BDSM, is it? DSM.
DSM, yeah.
Within that, there's like all bestiality and everything, and that is gradually closed in. And you read the book and you're like, ah, that is awful.
Mm.
It's... Oh, something care. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're like, oh, that's awful because you're just putting people into boxes. But you know what? Like, it's they still use it.
Yeah, I know.
And there is good reason to.
Of course.
Because essentially, like, we all need boxes to, like, navigate life. But
well, our behaviour is like, although it's unique to our to changeable. Us, it's unique to us as individuals. But it has a common denominator, and our reaction isn't it, although not typical in each time. There is a common reason or a common spark that puts you in a direction to behave a certain way.
What's that then?
Oh, who the fuck knows? It's down to the councillors to tell us.
I'm interested now. I thought you were going to blow my mind.
No. massively, man. I think as one thing I learned through this course is also how much childhood just affects everything.
Yeah.
Where you're just such a sponge, you know, so much you'll learn sort of behaviour, experiences, biases, sort of belief systems.
Yeah.
It's all childhood pretty much. Yeah. And it just sinks in so much then.
But scary, but I do think though, like the biological, like the kinetic energy that is used in you is the common denominator. We all react in a very similar way. Like when they say you shit yourself, your emotions are directly related to your guts. Like when you undergo stress or worry or anxiety, your stomach's in fucking bits always, right?
Yeah, like, this is a new area of thought, you know that.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, and it's interesting. It's interesting that being the common denominator that we are essentially human, and that is how we are, how our synapses work, how our reactive work, why we sweat under pressure. Like that has to biologically be the same for when we are undergoing something where we're not well mentally. There has to be a direct link to that. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of studies about it. I'm naive in that respect, but. But like just because of the way like your chemical imbalance, like your lack of serotonin, all of that is your body going, I'm trying to fix this somehow, right? But that we all do the same thing. It's just how we get there is always very different because the point of origin is always unique to us as an individual.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Massively. I mean, like you say, there is. Obviously, there's that thing you can always draw, you know, certain behaviours and certain boxes, but ultimately, you know, sort of the individual sort of like the ultimate minority, isn't it? You know, it is your experience. I think that's what you've got to try and look at for as a counsellor.
Yes.
It's your life experience. And everyone's... I think that's the other thing from earlier. I mean, definitely, it's awesome having that thing where if somebody comes in, you have a shared experience in terms of like anxiety.
Yeah.
It's also hard, and you've got to make sure not to just assume you know what has happened to them. It's like everyone's different, you know.
Yes.
It's, yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I'm getting there. Like the reaction might be the same, but your journey in which you got there, or the reasons you're sat writhing in bed at 7 a.m. in the morning before going to work, are very much yours, and they're only ever going to be resolved by you letting them known to somebody.
Yeah, man. I mean, what Nick said earlier there, like one of the other first things they said on the course they teach you is. Whether it's hypnotherapy or you know psychotherapy or you know anything, never ever if someone rings up and says hello, can I speak to you about getting counselling for my friend or husband or something? There's zero point because unless the person, the individual themselves wants to come and change things, you're never gonna you can't force someone to do anything like that.
No.
Yeah. You have to be either ready or in a hole. Mm. I think. Which is a shame, really. Most people tend to come when they're in a hole.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, in America, therapy's standard. There's very few things that I'll praise Americans about, apart from the Smashing Pumpkins, Jane's Addiction, and that.
It is interesting how in such a culturally diverse. Country that isn't always responsible for the most positive of social reactives.
It's a stiff upper lip thing.
Yeah, but the fact that they're so embracing of that, I think actually like
it is interesting.
I think it could drill down to the fact of like, and this may sound fucking a bit pie in the sky here, but if you consider like consumerism being the reason America exists, and the fact is if you deal with your problems, it means you're more likely to provide a better service to your employer and your job. And like and multinational companies thrive on the fact that the understanding, like post-Wall Street, everyone was fucking mental, high on drugs, but were running a lot of money and actually running the country.
But consumerism's the complete opposite to the answer.
Oh, of course it is. Of course it is. But this is what I mean. I'm saying it was brought up as a commodity to make, potentially. This is, again...
I think it's again, expensive in America.
It is, yeah. It is fucking expensive. But you always notice, like, L.A., like, yeah. I mean, I've been to LA a few times in the last couple of years, and yeah, it is a fucking cliche, but every person spoke about their therapist.
Everyone's got a therapist.
Everyone's got
spiritual.
A fucking therapist. Yeah.
Do you find, George?
It's interesting.
I found like as I've gone on my mental health journey and had lots of therapy, a lot of it comes back to some of that spiritual stuff. Like, have you had any experiences of that?
Can't really say I have, to be honest with you. I mean, all my stuff, it just feels very much like, almost with my thing, I guess a lot of people don't. I just didn't recognise when it first started it was anxiety.
Right.
And I just sort of thought, oh, that's just a one-off, you know, having a panic attack or something. Mm. That's just a one-off. And it just kept happening and happening until by the time I realised it was so bad that it was sort of like crippling my ability to sort of function normally in life. Mm. I think this is what I think, where a lot of people end up, like you were saying, people end up in a hole. Like by the time I was sort of needed, you know, really needed to do something about it and see a psychiatrist or get help of some sort, I just couldn't see any sort of conceivable way out of it. I just thought I just thought that's my life from now on.
Right.
And also going back to the thing you said about psychosis earlier, I think you sort of cross into psychosis from neurosis when you almost start buying your own shtick.
Yeah.
Like you don't know anymore that this is an issue. Like you're not aware of it.
Yeah.
You just, this is life now. You know, you buy it that this is reality.
Yeah.
You know, you just completely disassociate from what I guess, you know, a typical functioning brain would reason with things and then calculate, so you know, threats and issues.
Yeah, it's so scary, though, isn't it? Because you hear the term psychosis, and you're like, especially if you work in that area, psychosis seems really, really heavy, and it is.
Mm.
And like when I realised that I was borderline, and that the borderline was, you're borderline psychotic, I was like, oh fuck.
Mm.
And then like I was like, actually, yeah. You know, sometimes, yeah. Sometimes, like, I believe what my head's telling me, and...
Yeah.
And it's fucking terrible. George, tips. Tips, advice. Give me some of those one-liners. What have you learned? What has been the things you've learned along the way?
I think definitely it's going to be an obvious one, but just... Don't keep stuff to yourself. If you're worried about something, speak to whether it's your mates or a therapist or just someone. Like, if you're really worried, just because I think, and this is why I think, you know, your fellas, this podcast is brilliant. To, you know, just raise awareness, because there's so many people, a lot of men, you sort of as well, you know, largely, you sort of come to realise that just think it's like mingy, or they don't want to talk about their feelings or worried.
Yeah.
And a lot of people live really miserable lives because of that for long periods of time. Or you know, people end up dying from it, you know. It's really fucking sad.
It is, mate. It is.
And I think that's why, going back to the original question about why you get into the counselling, I just think for me, if I can stop someone from feeling as shit as I did, you know, I'll be happy with that, really.
But you will every day, you know, that's the thing. Like, I found since kind of getting more stuck in with working with mental health is that you don't need to do a lot to make a difference. You know, often it's giving someone an opportunity to speak is good enough, you know, like that's what they fucking need.
Yeah.
And that's what we all need. Yeah, it's quite insane. I use words like insane and mad today. That's really bad.
They're only words, mate.
It's where it's so wide, especially into like sort of odd, like dialect in Essex and stuff, isn't it? Like mental, mad. It's just like words. Yeah. They just sort of come to you naturally, don't they? Sometimes
it's like using the word cunt as a term of endearment. is the best way.
Yeah, I'm not that bad.
I mean, I am.
I'm well middle class.
I am. No. This is growing up with my mum. Well, not my mum, my dad. Bethnal Green. This is it.
You're so much posher than me. Everyone's posher than me. It pisses me off. George speaks better than me. What the fuck's wrong? And I think the way I speak is lazy as shit. And I think the reason I speak this way, my mum tells me it's because I was deaf and I was young, and I was that I didn't. I just learnt sounds rather than syllables.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it is insecurity. You know, like, I start talking and then everything just blurs. And that is because, like, halfway through I'm thinking, they're not fucking interested.
Mm.
You know, like, so much is born out of insecurity.
You're wrong there. But it's interesting with having, like, yeah, I know what you mean by the use of a voice.
Yeah.
See, because I adapt my voice for situation, and I'm quite good at it as well. Like I can be quite articulate, or I can just be an absolute scummer from the market.
Yeah.
And it's just that. But that's a crossbreed of the friends I've got and where I grew
really
up.
Vary that much. Mine's like, oh, he sounds really stoned.
Yeah,
that's pretty much.
You do sound quite stoned, and also I'm a bit deaf, and I'm really fucking loud. I'm definitely a bit deaf, so everyone thinks I'm the loudest person in the world, and I don't hear it. So
you know? Let's have another tip, Georgie.
Yeah, go on, mate. Yeah,
go on.
Another tip. Definitely, we sort of mentioned it earlier. Definitely, when you do, if you do go for therapy, just persevere with it and make sure you find a therapist that suits you. Mm. You know, don't give up too quick. If you go to a couple and you think, oh, this ain't for me, or they, you know, it don't work. It's just finding someone that you can have a good rapport with and that you can be yourself with and, you know, feel relaxed with, basically.
Yeah.
I think rapport is key all day long.
Mm.
Like, if you've got rapport with someone, they don't necessarily, you know, like that person-centred.
Mm.
If you get on with someone, you'll end up talking yourself into the answers.
Yeah.
You know, like, so the person-centered thing does work. But if I went straight into person-centered therapy and they're like, I'm not going to say anything.
Mm.
Like,
yeah.
I'll wait till you feel awkward enough to say something and then I'll be like, then, you know, I couldn't deal with that.
Have you seen The Sopranos?
Yeah, it's my favourite show.
So have you seen The Sopranos, George?
I've actually never watched The Sopranos.
That's my favourite show.
So
my favourite TV show.
Very
and
quickly,
I'm obsessed with TV.
It's amazing. It's still my favourite show, but it becomes centred around him and his therapist, James Gandolfini's character and Isabella Rossellini. Yeah. So around his therapist. And what's interesting is it just becomes his focus therapy, right? So every time, I mean, and there's some beautiful scenes in it that are hilarious because he walks in, says something, goes, ah, fuck you, and walks out, and she says nothing. Mm. She literally says nothing on a few occasions. He tries to have sex with her, like loads of shit, because of the relationship. And the point of that, when you analyse it after, is that he values the relationship he has with her so fucking highly because it's clearly affecting his life in and making him realise what he's doing. I mean, it eventually leads to his demise, more or less. But like, it's that as a snapshot is amazing to me.
He goes through this period where he needs to belittle and break her because she's a woman.
Yes,
and he's the fucking gangman.
Yeah.
She resists.
Yeah,
and then he's like,
oh shit. Yeah, all
right.
I can't fuck with you.
Seen through the game of me being a big guy. And then it's like, oh fuck, then I'm naked.
Yeah, so yeah, and then it didn't matter. And then he starts fantasizing about him.
Yeah, you've got to watch that, Jules. That's fucking good.
Honestly, dude, loads of them. It's a hard slog But
it's not a hard slog match.
I mean, no, it isn't. But it's
a lot of them.
There's a lot of them, is
the
what
end
I mean.
Shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey.
And the end is a bit pony.
Yeah, the ending's a letdown, but don't let that fool you, because the journey's the way.
I got through that in 6 months when my daughter was born.
Yeah,
I fed her in the middle of the night.
Just watching that, yeah.
And
I
like,
think I did something similar with Lola.
And it's fucking like, fuck, yeah. Cunt, fuck, strippers, fuck, cunt. And I'm feeding my brilliant. Daughter at 3 o'clock in the morning with a bottle. Just going, oh,
New yeah. Jersey Mafia.
Yeah,
it's
we're
brilliant.
Going to the next one, and I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
I've been recommending it so many times, so I've got
but,
to get on
but
it.
Honestly, for just
but
just
the psychological
from a
really
psychological point of view, it's yeah. like it made me sort of like think about things in a different way. And I think with like obviously with like you know with any form of creative industry and lyricism and whatever else, you can relate it and personalize it to yourself, right? And I think it therapy's one, especially in the UK. Like as we said before, in America, it's a fucking standard for people with a bit of wealth to have that relationship. But to promote it here, it seems that it has to be stem from a problem, yeah. as opposed to it stem from this will just do you good, mate.
Yeah,
because if like my dad's old school, he's you know he's 60 odd years of age, and he's suffered. I mean. He'll never listen to this, so it don't matter. But even if he did, I've got nothing to hide. But he suffered from anxiety about nothing for a long, long time. Mm. And that seeped into me in my later teens and that. And in my early 20s. And I just had the same behaviour. And it's like, when you're exposed to other bits and bobs, you then go, fuck, actually, that was quite just him because he didn't have the relationships he needed, and I've sort of adopted them too, where I have got the relationships. I'm just copycatting, and yeah. it's funny with that because like I use counselling now and again now, just when I need to, I'll talk to somebody. Mm. But I've got a relationship with a guy that I can just phone him up and have a chat, like, and that's it. But I haven't needed to, actually, because of my friends and stuff. But to get to that point, a lot of people, especially sort of younger Essex, East London-y, sort of like, you know, are all from sort of hardened...
People are much
hardened,
more liberal now,
yeah.
though.
They are now.
That age group,
yeah. Well, we've spoken about sort of the next generation being far, far, far more advanced in many ways.
You're coming on leaps and bounds. You really are.
Cheers,
I gave him a little pat on the back, then. Yeah. So I'm like... Yeah, that was really lovely what you said.
Yeah, I think I believe that it's I've only ever benefited from being honest about shit, right? And sorry, there was a moth there just then. And
I'm trying to kill it with my fang.
Oh, mate, Buddhist over
here. I like moths because I'm a goth.
Of course you are. That's it. But it's interesting for me because you know I really enjoy this situation almost as a form of therapy in a way. And I think, as you said, Jules, like what we're doing and what Nick's been doing prior to me joining, obviously, is signposting the fact that the belief in understanding that we all have shit going on. Like every single person walking this planet has something they need to deal with,
yeah.
and it will affect ultimately yourself or somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite true. I think you being sort of an advocate for that. Is very encouraging because you know you're in your mid 20s, you sort of your early 20s.
Handsome bloke, handsome.
Yeah, handsome, fucking handsome, sorting it out. But this is it, and it will make it on the next wave of us all becoming a bit more sort of emotionally attached to our direct and actually our physical, not just our emotional, because we harbour shit and we do it. We used to do it, as we said, by fighting and fucking being an arsehole, but. We are getting better, and it will only be furthermore promoted by people like yourself offering a service eventually, but also having your own shtick about it and your own approach, and hopefully will inspire other people to do it. Do you know what I mean? Because I certainly know that would have helped me on my initial journey on it, like with it, you know.
Yeah, Matt. If I can, I'd be over the moon if I could get even one person to just think about getting therapy. I think as well with something that
it's a strange one because obviously looking at it now, I've had therapy and you know that it's really helpful. A lot of people, like friends of mine have mentioned it before, and they're like, I don't know how I thought about it. And my thing to them is just, you know what, you can't lose anything going to therapy. Yeah. Everything's confidential. Nothing's going to get mentioned. I said, just try it once, or, you know, just for the sake of it, and just tell me how bad it is. I don't really know. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about therapy that you're going to come in and it's going to pick your sort of brain apart and really try and look into your life. It doesn't work like that, obviously, as you guys know. It's all about empathy and...
You can control that as well, you know, like when you go into therapy, like if you don't want to talk about something, then you don't.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like you can control that.
I think the majority of us, though, when we get a bit of a confidence, and you know, like I'm obviously generalising, but you do feel the need to then sort of give a bit more because it's never going to be a negative situation, is it?
Yeah.
It's not. And as you said, you are in control of that situation. You're able to sort of, if you wanted to, I mean, even if you had therapy and lied through it all, like, because you can, and not that you'd be judged or whatever. I mean, I don't know. Have you ever done that? Have you ever lied through for a full session?
Yeah, I lied for a year.
Did you?
Yeah. When I had my first therapy at Basildon Hospital when I was about 11, and I lied through all of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but that's, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
All of it. And, because I was scared.
Yeah.
And
I was getting to that.
It took me a long time to get to a point things had to get so bad for me to be honest.
Mm.
For me to see no other option but to fucking commit. And and as you say, like, we're not in a culture where we promote that.
Mm.
But that's why I love what you said, George, really, is that the idea is that just by you being there breaks the stigma. You know, you start to break the stigma just by purely doing it, just by fucking walking the walk.
Mm.
And it's also quite surprising that along the way you learn a lot about yourself as well by getting involved with that. Mm. You're like, I've learned stuff about myself from talking to you tonight.
Mm.
You know, I do every week.
Mm.
Some more so, but very much from you, George, is that, you learn about yourself by just talking and the power of actually saying things aloud. Like, that's my big thing, really, is that the power of saying it aloud, then suddenly you get a perspective.
Yeah, massive. I think as well, a lot of time especially with men, I think, they have this idea with mental health and they don't understand it's a shared problem. They really think there's something that's really wrong with just them and that it's their problem alone.
Mm.
But like you say, just by speaking about it, and I think everyone's done it at some point.
I've definitely done that, all day long. Yeah.
It's not like you've got some sort of rare disease. You know, it's anxiety or it's stress, you know. And it's one of them, the more you, by talking, the only way you're going to get better is by talking about it, you know.
Mm.
You just repress things otherwise. It just gets worse and worse, you know.
Mm. Well, this is it. It's about promoting positive change.
Oh, fuck, George. Fuck, you just gave me a moment.
Yeah.
I just had a fucking moment.
Mm.
Like, the concept of mental health is a shared problem.
Yeah.
And it's not a personal problem.
Mm.
So the answer...
Mm.
It's to share. Fucking hell, George. That was a really good one.
Mm.
10 out, like, that was really good.
Mm.
We're going to have to wrap up.
Yeah.
That was really good. I like that, though. Oh, fucking hell. What a good thing to finish on.
Mm.
It's a shared problem.
Mm.
Yeah, man.
Like, you can't do it in isolation. You know what? I think that is... best message I've ever heard. I'm going to start sharing that shit.
Yeah, do it. Of course.
It's a shared problem. Thank you, George.
Cheers, George.
I really enjoyed that.
Honestly, lads, my pleasure. It's been great.
I'm sorry, like, quite often, I know we've talked a lot, but I think we're ironing out our cracks as we go.
Oh yeah, for sure. I am all day long. I still am.
I'm learning, and I've learned loads from you tonight. It's been great,
George. Thank you very much.
Thank you, George.
It's been lovely having you on, and we'll have you on next season for sure to see where you're at. Yeah.
Nice one, fellas. Yeah, definitely.
Thank you, George. Thank you.
Cheers, matey.
Take care, everyone.
Take care, everyone. Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.